Let's talk now about what a good instructional framework looks like. The gold standard is what we call a qualitative rubric. And in this section, we're going to compare and contrast that gold standard qualitative rubric with some of the inferior substitutes that seem to keep popping up in our profession. So first things first, let's get one thing clear, that an instructional framework is a rubric. It is not simply a list of strategies, it is not simply a list of characteristics of effective teaching, and it's not simply a list of buzzwords. It's actually a rubric that is organized into components and levels of performance. And when it comes to making expectations clear and more specific, we have to be very careful that we don't take our expectations and turn them into an instrument that we use for observation or evaluation or whatever purpose that has unintended negative consequences. So the big challenge in using shared expectations that we're going to address in this section, and then we'll address the others in upcoming sections, is this challenge of design. There is a risk that when we design an instrument with expectations for teaching, that it will miss the point or that it will send us in the wrong direction and distract us from the improvement work that we could be doing if we design a well thought out instrument. So again, the gold standard for those types of instructional frameworks is what we call a qualitative rubric. And what I thought we would do in this section is compare each of these, and I'll give you several examples, both real world examples, and I have a made up example just for fun, so that you can see the differences between qualitative rubrics, what we call frequency and extent rubrics, checklists, and rating scales. So kind of going from best to worst here. So let's jump right in to the first type, the gold standard instructional framework, which is a true rubric. And if you use an evaluation system like Danielson's framework for teaching, or perhaps Kim Marshall's teacher and principal evaluation rubrics, or perhaps something that was developed by James Strong, or perhaps something that was developed within your district or based on a modification of one of the above, you've probably seen some pretty high quality, true qualitative rubrics. And I think the Danielson framework is probably the best known example. It's used in the majority of states, I think, across the US, and definitely is the number one framework for evaluating teacher practice. And it's broken into four domains, each of which has five or six components. And really, any one of these domains or even any one of these components could be considered an instructional framework by itself. And any work that you and your teachers do to design your own frameworks is, of course, not going to be this ambitious. It's not going to cover this much ground, and it doesn't need to. So we're going to look at just a small piece of the Danielson framework as an example of the kind of rubric that you may want to develop for specific expectations within your school. So if we zoom in to domain three, which is instruction, I know this is too small to read here, but the components of the domain for instruction are A, communicating with students, B, using questioning and discussion techniques, C, engaging students in learning, D, using assessment in instruction, and E, demonstrating flexibility and responsiveness. And again, this is just one page of the rubric. It's got very small text, and it has a lot of text in each column for the different levels of performance. So we've got unsatisfactory, basic, proficient, and distinguished. And notice that typically distinguished has more text in it, right? There are more layers that are being added when we get up to that highest level of performance. And that will show up in a number of different ways as we talk about the distinctions between these different types of instruments. So in a true qualitative leveled rubric, really there is a qualitative difference between the levels of performance. It looks different, it feels different, it has different characteristics, and it's not just more or less of the same as you go from one column to the next. Teachers aren't just doing more or, you know, more consistent or, you know, more often of those same practices. They're actually engaging in different practices at different levels of performance. For example, if we look at 3A, communicating with students, it says in the proficient column that the instructional purpose of the lesson is clearly communicated to students, including where it's situated within the broader learning. But in the distinguished column, it says the teacher links the instructional purpose of the lesson to the larger curriculum. When it comes to anticipating misunderstandings, that's not mentioned at all in the proficient column, but it is in the distinguished column. And also added in the distinguished column is the sense of student ownership, you know, that students contribute to the extending the content by explaining concepts to their classmates. And that's a theme throughout the Danielson framework, is that in the distinguished column, we've added on this layer of student ownership. And not everything is teacher directed anymore, because that's been handed over to students. That is, to Danielson, a big characteristic of level four distinguished practice. So that qualitative difference is going to be incredibly useful to us in feedback conversations, because we can see it in a moment. I can't be present for every lesson that a teacher teaches, but I can be present for one lesson and then talk about what I saw. And if I know what qualitatively the distinction is between basic and proficient and distinguished, I'm going to be able to see that even if I only have one example. I don't have to be there all the time to get a sense of what that teacher's practice is like. And to illustrate this, throughout the remainder of this section, I wanted to share kind of a fun example of a rubric for wearing a necktie. I think it's easy to get zoomed into our specific instructional concerns. So I thought to contrast the differences between these different types of instructional frameworks, we would just do this one as a kind of a fun way to compare them. So if I were to come up with a gold standard qualitative rubric for wearing a necktie, I would have, again, unsatisfactory, basic, proficient, and distinguished. And in the unsatisfactory category, you know, maybe the necktie is missing entirely, maybe it's ripped, maybe it's stained, maybe it's badly out of style or just does not match the suit. And then as you go up in performance, you know, we have things like, you know, it gets cleaner, it's properly tied, it's a modern style that matches the suit in the proficient category, the length and the knot are appropriate. And then in the distinguished category, extremely stylish, the knot is appropriate for the shirt collar and the weight of the tie, which we have not mentioned earlier. So we're adding some additional dimensions into our consideration at the distinguished level of performance. Tied perfectly, pocket square might be an option for distinguished, right? So we can add additional dimensions that we weren't even worrying about at the lower levels of performance. Now, a great example of a rubric that does this pretty well, but also exhibits some characteristics of the next kind of framework that we're going to talk about is Kim Marshall's rubric. And Kim actually makes these rubrics available open source on his website at marshallmemo.com, and they're excellent rubrics. But I wanted to share this particular example of domain A, component A, knowledge. If you read along the top line here, around teacher knowledge, is expert in the subject area. And then we'll go straight to the next column, knows the subject matter well. And then in the third column, by the way, we're going the opposite direction here, so we're going from best to worst. In the third column, improvement necessary, it says is somewhat familiar with the subject. And then in the lowest category, does not meet standards, the top row says has little familiarity with the subject matter. And what we're starting to see here is that this is, to some extent, what we call a frequency and extent rubric. And what's really happening here is that we're not describing true qualitative differences between levels of performance. We're describing the extent to which one expectation is met, or perhaps how often that expectation is met, or perhaps to some extent how many characteristics are expected. And this is where the boundary gets a little bit fuzzy between frequency extent rubrics and those true qualitative rubrics. You know, you have to do a little bit of that kind of how many dimensions do we pay attention to description. But the thing we have to be careful about is not just packing the rubric with checklist items. That's what we want to avoid to make a truly useful, high quality rubric. Another example rubric when it comes to teacher evaluation is Jim Strong's rubric from Strong and Associates. And again, this is a pretty good high quality rubric. You've got a performance standard at the top, you've got performance indicators, but then look at the rubric. You've got effective in the purple row. Effective is the expected level of performance. And then if you go over to the left and look at highly effective, it says in addition to meeting the requirements for effective, the teacher also does these things. And again, it's okay to add layers as you go up in higher levels of performance. But if you look at partially effective, what's the difference between effective and partially effective? Well, it starts out, the teacher is inconsistent in the use of the state standards, the school's curriculum, data, or strategies and resources to meet the needs of all students. So inconsistency is a legitimate problem. So I respect the fact that Strong has included that here, but inconsistency is also very difficult to observe. So if we want to have an evidence-based conversation, we're going to have some challenges. Now, that's not always a challenge if the purpose of the rubric is simply for teacher self-reflection. For example, this is a rubric from the Responsive Classroom curriculum. And if you are thinking about your own practice, you can reflect on how consistent you are with something or how often you do that. And that's okay. So this can be useful. But we have to be careful about defining the differences between levels of performance solely in terms of frequency or consistency. Because when we're observing, when we're using our observations as evidence for a discussion, for a conversation with the teacher, or ultimately for a high-stakes decision, we have to keep in mind that we may not actually have very much evidence about frequency or extent or consistency. For example, in the top row of this rubric, the highest level of performance says teacher always uses calm, respectful voice. The middle level, which is 3 out of 5, I guess it's actually a 5-point scale, the teacher sometimes uses a calm, respectful voice. And then the lowest level of performance actually does have some qualitative differences. It's not just about inconsistency. There actually is a qualitative difference here. So this one's kind of in between too. It says teacher often speaks with raised, angry, sarcastic, pleading, or rushed voice. So again, this one has some elements of both the qualitative and the frequency extent rubrics. And that's true for many rubrics. You may come up with one and realize that it's kind of a combination. The more you can get the differences between levels of performance to be truly qualitatively different, the easier it's going to be to use that rubric in conversation and have evidence that backs your kind of assignment of what you saw to a particular category. So let's look at what that might be for our necktie example. What would it be like to have a frequency extent rubric for a necktie? We might say level 1 is never wears a tie. Level 2 is sometimes wears a tie. Level 3 is consistently wears an appropriately styled and tied tie. And level 4 is always. But here's the problem with that kind of language about sometimes, consistently, always, never. It's not always about that, right? More, doing something more often is often not the point. And we risk entirely missing the point of the improvement opportunity in front of us. So we've already mentioned that it can be hard to document frequency and extent. I don't know how often the teacher uses an appropriate voice or uses an inappropriate voice. Like that's very difficult for me to document as an observer. And when it comes to improvement, we want to make sure that there's actually a vision for what better looks like. And in a qualitative rubric, you have that vision. You just look over in the next column and it's described crystal clear so the teacher knows what to do. With a frequency extent rubric, the takeaway for the teacher is often, well, try harder at that or do more of it or be more consistent. And that's not always the path to improvement. Just as the path to better tie wearing is not to wear a tie 24 hours a day or to wear a bigger tie, you know, more is not always better. And that becomes even more apparent when we get down to the next type of framework that we're going to talk about in this section, the checklist. So we're getting lower and lower in quality here. Checklists can be useful. They can serve a purpose, especially around data collection. If you just want to know, you know, to what extent are we using these particular practices? For example, this is from a school district in Texas that was interested in collecting data on the use of Teach Like a Champion techniques in their classrooms. You can, of course, go around and observe and mark off which strategies you're seeing in different classrooms. But we're probably not going to get very far in an improvement conversation using a checklist. And again, if we explain by way of analogy, the items on our checklist might be correct, and they might even be exactly the same as the items on our high quality rubric, like the tie is clean, it's knotted appropriately, it matches, and so on. But again, we risk missing the point. And often when it comes to improvement, how is more important than whether or to what extent or how often. When it comes to improvement, we want to know how a teacher is making decisions so that we can improve that decision making. We can have an impact on the teacher's practice in terms of quality, not just frequency or quantity. When it comes to any kind of improvement or evaluative purpose, we miss out on the path to growth if we reduce our rubric to just a checklist. And we have to be really careful about the risk of gaming the system, right? If the teacher knows you know, we have to have the objective written on the board, and there has to be a turn and talk, you know, all these things, these little checklist kind of things that we're looking for, they can cram all of those checklist items into a lesson that's still not a good lesson, right? We can entirely miss the point, and we can be even less helpful in that if we get very arbitrary about what we're looking for. I heard an example just the other day that I remember was a problem in my school district a decade ago around using turn and talks, right? There had been an expectation in this district that teachers would use turn and talks as an engagement strategy, and principals were looking for turn and talks. And teachers knew that principals were looking for turn and talks and collecting data on how often their teachers were doing turn and talks. So lo and behold, teachers happened to always do a turn and talk when there was an administrator watching. Now, we can ask ourselves how often or how much we can really conclude from that if it becomes this kind of gamed response to an expectation. Is it really helpful? I'm going to guess that that it's not. And the more arbitrary we are with what goes on our checklist, the more destructive this gets in terms of the quality of our feedback conversations. For example, if I become very picky about my expectations and say, you know what, it's not enough to have a properly tied knot, it has to be a half Windsor. And it's not enough to have a stylish tie, it has to be a black silk tie and not too wide, it has to be skinny because that's what I like. That sounds ridiculous, but we do that with teaching strategies. And we'll talk later in this module about pet strategies and the danger of overemphasizing certain pet strategies and not really looking at the big picture of teacher decision making. So we've got to not miss the point when it comes to defining our expectations. And of course, we can even further miss the point with a rating scale, which, like a checklist, may describe different areas of performance, but without that rich description that's present in a rubric. For example, this is the Elliott 2.0 observation tool. And if you read some of the descriptions, they sound fine. You know, learners engage in differentiated learning opportunities that meet their needs. Learners have equal access to classroom discussions. Learners are treated in a fair, clear, and consistent manner. Those are all good things. I don't have any argument with any of those criteria. The problem here is the rating scale itself. What does it mean to be a level 4 or a level 3 or a level 2? I don't know. We don't have any kind of calibration here in terms of what evidence should lend itself to a particular rating. So it becomes kind of arbitrary on the observer's part, and we can try to calibrate our observations. You know, we can do these observations together. We can train everybody to watch the same video and give the same rating. But if it's not really evidence-based, and if there's no description in a rubric of what level 2 or level 3 or level 4 practice looks like, we're missing that roadmap to growth that we would have if we were using a true qualitative rubric. And of course, in our necktie example, we could come up with a rating scale that has the same criteria as that rubric, but if we're missing the description, we're not really going to know. Well, you know, what does style mean? If I am a teacher who is, you know, metaphorically wearing an unstylish tie, what do I do to improve? That often is the missing piece in our feedback conversations. We know there's a problem, we know we're not happy with what we're seeing, but we don't know what to tell the person to do differently, right? So those rating scales are pretty common. It's great to see rating scales get replaced by higher quality rubrics in a lot of cases, like with the Danielson framework's growing popularity. But when we're missing those descriptions, we're really kind of hamstrung in our ability to help teachers grow through that feedback conversation. So the gold standard, again, is a leveled rubric with clear qualitative differences between each level of performance, not just varying degrees of the same thing. And that's true whether we're talking about a framework or an instrument that's been developed by your state, by your province, by your district, or something that you make in-house. And what I'd like to ask you to do now is get your journal out and reflect on these two questions. First, thinking about your teacher evaluation instrument, what you officially use to evaluate teachers. Is it a true qualitative rubric, the gold standard? Is it a frequency and extent rubric, and often it will be a combination of those two? Is it a checklist or is it a rating scale? I find that many schools that develop their own in-house teacher evaluation system start with a checklist or a rating scale because, frankly, they're much simpler to develop. So there may be an opportunity there to flesh that out into a more robust rubric. Not a project you have to take on right now, but just something to think about long term. And as you think about developing smaller rubrics for more targeted improvement work, how can you make that rubric fit the definition that we talked about in this section of a true qualitative rubric? And then the second question, what other shared expectations do we use that fit these descriptions? Are there other look-fors or rubrics or protocols or observation instruments or walkthrough instruments or rounds protocols that you use in your organization? And if you can identify those, then you can identify an opportunity to move to a higher quality instrument. That's it for this section. So when you've filled out your journal, you're ready to move on.